You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Brookings Institution. My name is Megan Bradley, and I'm a fellow here with the Brookings LSE Project on Internal Displacement. And I'd like to thank everyone for joining us for today's event, the Kampala Convention on Internal Displacement, a Human Rights Milestone. So the aim of today's event is to celebrate the landmark achievement of the adoption and entry into force of the Kampala Convention. We'll be examining its implications for the protection of internally displaced persons, or IDPs, in Africa, and also strategies to support the effective implementation of the agreement. It's a particular pleasure for the Brookings LSE Project to be hosting today's event, because as many of you will know, we work very closely to support the human rights of IDPs around the world, and in particular to support the mandate of Dr. Chiloka Bayani, the Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Internally Displaced Persons. One of the main objectives for the mandate and for the work of our project over the upcoming 5 years is to provide concerted support for this agreement and the possibilities that it holds for IDP protection in Africa. Chiloka is the co-director of our project, and so it's always particularly great to have him with us. In this work, we work very closely with a range of organizations and states, and so I would like to say a special welcome to the members of the Diplomatic Corps who are with us here today. The ambassador of the African Union had actually also hoped to join us for today's event, but unfortunately was unavailable. But I think that this will be the beginning of a longer conversation here at Brookings on the Kampala Convention, and so we'll hope to welcome our AU colleagues for future events. By a quick word of background, as many of you will know, the Kampala Convention came into force on December 6, 2012. And this is the first regional binding agreement on internally displaced persons in the world. But it does build on important precedents. Perhaps foremost among them would be the guiding principles on internal displacement, the key normative standard for IDPs around the world. Like the guiding principles, the Kampala Convention focuses first and foremost on national responsibility for internal displacement, and it addresses the rights of IDPs at every stage of displacement. In addition to the guiding principles, the Kampala Convention also integrates and builds on insights coming from important agreements like the Great Lakes Protocol on IDPs, in which Chiloka Bayani was also quite extensively involved. The Kampala Convention, though, also breaks new ground in terms of looking at the responsibilities of states as well as regional organizations to responding to IDPs in Africa, and it strengthens international norms on key issues such as the prohibition on arbitrary displacement, and it strengthens the rights of IDPs and others who are affected by displacement to a remedy for the harms that they've suffered in association with their displacement. So this is not only a convention that strengthens the current standards, but also advances the bar in terms of IDP protection on the continent. This is particularly important, as many of you will know, because sub-Saharan Africa at the moment is host to one-third of the world's internally displaced persons. And I know many of us in the room today are really hoping that this is a convention that is going to make a concrete contribution to improving the rights and well-being of these individuals. Now, making the most of the convention is obviously going to require meeting several challenges. And first and foremost, perhaps amongst those, is addressing issues of ratification. At the moment, there are 16 states that have signed and ratified the agreement, and amongst those are several states that do have large IDP populations, such as Mali, Chad, and the Central African Republic. But many of you will also know that there are many countries with large IDP populations, such as the DRC and Côte d'Ivoire, that have signed the agreement but not yet ratified. And there are several other countries, such as Sudan, South Sudan, and Kenya, that have very large IDP populations but have not yet signed or ratified the agreement. So part of today's discussion will look at how key actors such as the United States can encourage more states in Africa to sign and ratify the agreement. But in addition to this challenge, we of course have to face the question of the effective implementation of the agreement. This entails the development of national laws and policies on internal displacement as is required in the convention itself. And fundamentally, of course, this is not just a humanitarian question or a human rights question, but also it's fundamentally a matter of development. It's about good governance and how do we strengthen the rule of law in many of the states that are facing these challenges across the African continent. So to address these issues, we're very glad to have with us three leading panelists today. First, Dr. Chaloka Bayani, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of IDPs and co-director of the Brookings LSC Project on Internal Displacement. He'll be sharing with us some of his thoughts as Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of IDPs and as one of the lead drafters of the Kampala Convention. After we hear from Chaloka, we'll have comments from Niels Herold on my right. Niels is the lead social development specialist focusing on displacement issues with the World Bank, and he'll be sharing some of his reflections on the development implications of the convention. And then last, on my far left, we'll turn to Andrea Lari, who's the director of programs at Refugees International. He'll be reflecting on some of the advocacy questions that the convention raises, addressing issues including how to engage the United States in supporting the convention and how to bring more countries on board as signatories and countries that have ratified the agreement. So I'll ask each of our speakers to offer us their reflections for about 10 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions and comments from the floor. So thank you in advance to our speakers, and we look forward to your thoughts.
Thank you very much, Megan, for your kind introduction, and I'm very delighted to be back at Brookings here, especially as I co-direct the project on internal displacement with Elizabeth Ferry somewhere in the audience. And so Brookings has become very much part of my stomping ground as well. I'll try and give a sense of the background to the convention, its framework, the nature of the obligations without being legalistic, looking at implementation as well, and also the framework for compliance and monitoring compliance with the convention. It's the first ever regional instrument that's binding, as Megan has said, on the issue of IDPs, but it actually started with a very intense discussion within the African Union of the fact that Africa hosted more than 16 million IDPs, and also that Africa did have a legal framework specifically for dealing with refugees, but not with IDPs. And so there was this imbalance that African states gradually, with the success of the project on displacement and recognition and acceptance of the guiding principles on internal displacement and the Great Lakes Protocol, came to the conclusion that it was necessary to elaborate a legal framework on IDPs in Africa. And that decision 1295/2004 remains historical for those reasons. And as Megan has mentioned, the convention entered in force on the 6th of December 2012, after Swaziland also has a mark of its own history, deposited the 15th instrument of ratification. A great deal of advocacy around the Friends of the Kampala Convention, in which the project was involved, the mandate, UNHCR and other agencies, clearly created the momentum for ratification in a very strategic way, so that so far as African conventions go, it's actually rare to have an instrument that was adopted in 2009 and entered in force in 2012, 3 years after it's being adopted. The path to negotiation and adoption of the convention was not easy. There were times when you thought, well, this is it. It has actually collapsed because of different interests. And I think it was with a great sigh of collective relief when the heads of states in Kampala adopted the convention after much debate even between themselves, which was also unusual because the heads of states usually simply agree after the ministers have adopted an instrument. But this made history in the sense that the debate went right from the experts to the ministers and right after the heads of states before it was adopted. As to the framework of the convention, it was negotiated with a view to achieving a common consensus on its framework, and also to achieve a common understanding on the issue of displacement and of the way in which the framework should respond to the problem of displacement in Africa. The major question that the participants asked themselves was, how should in 50 years' time Africa deal with the problem of IDPs? That was one positive question. The response to that question by others who were detractors was that, well, what if in 50 years' time there are no more IDPs in Africa? And so you had those currents all the time underlying the debate, forwards and backwards, until we made progress. It starts with a preamble, which has quite a good number of paragraphs. But the importance of that is actually it underlies the framework of the convention. It recognized the phenomenon of displacement in terms of magnitude. It laid out the vision of the African Union to deal with displacement, indicated the founding legal principles, including the guiding principles, and finally balanced state sovereignty with protecting IDPs. And for those reasons, the first experts meeting only considered three paragraphs of the preamble in a whole week's meeting and ended there. The discussion never went forward. So further meetings had to be held to actually look at the further substance. In terms of the obligations are fairly unique in the sense that they relate to states, they relate to non-state actors, they relate to the African Union, they also relate to international organizations. Rarely will you find a treaty that encompasses obligations of that kind. Most treaties will have obligations related to states because states are the states' parties. But this broke ground by looking at the role of non-state actors because they are fairly active agents in the process of displacement. It also broke ground in the sense that it reached out to armed groups. As the groups that are mostly actively involved in displacement. And the tension there ran throughout the negotiating history. On the one hand, the states with displaced populations recognized the role and the damage done by armed groups. Those who had not experienced displacement said, well, but we're legitimizing armed groups in the context of a convention that is dealing with the obligations of states, and we don't want these obligations. And that argument reached all the way to the summit when President Mugabe, as I've said before, simply raised the question, are we legitimizing armed groups? And he was answered very effectively by the DRC, the Central African Republic, and others who say this is where the problem lies. And unless we deal with armed groups, we're skating around the surface. The issue then became, fine, we're not going to legitimize them, but we're going to find language which says that the inclusion of armed groups is without prejudice. To state sovereignty and other obligations under international law. The objectives are what underpin the entire convention. The fabric of the convention and its rollout would be understood by looking at the objectives to try and prevent conditions contributing to displacement, providing protection and assistance during displacement and in all phases of displacement. So the convention was actually drafted as an ABC of how you protect IDPs in the field. It was not drafted for lawyers. It was drafted with a view to say if X is in a camp or a location and IDPs have just been displaced, which aspect of this convention will guide them? Or IDPs have now reached their places of displacement, where they are. What are their needs? What do we do with those? Or it's time to apply durable solutions. What does the person in the field do in relation to durable solutions? So it's a cycle around which all the phases of displacement are captured in that way, so that it's user-friendly and it also corresponds to what is needed in the convention. There are then certain themes that run throughout the convention and which are important to appreciate. The first of which is ownership of the convention and responsibility for its implementation by African states themselves and to take responsibility for the issue of displacement. And the convention is evidence of that ownership. Then a partnership between the African Union and its member states and international organizations and civil society. International organizations actively participated in drafting this convention. And the decision by the African Union to draft the convention also recognized that there would be a partnership between Africa and the international community. And for that reason, there are obligations that reach out to international organizations, irrespective of their mandates. And here, again, the issues were these organizations have got their own mandates. And then they assume additional obligations under this convention. And how do we reconcile that? The reconciliation was that the obligations will be exercised in accordance with the mandates of those international organizations, but there has to be a cohesive framework within which the organizations engage with African states and the African Union civil society on the basis of partnership. So partnership runs through, not just in terms of formulation, but also in terms of the implementation of the convention. Comprehensiveness in not just addressing all phases of displacement, but the convention clearly applies to any type of displacement irrespective of cause. So we have a definition of an IDP in the guiding principles, but there's also a clear statement that it will apply to any form of displacement and very explicitly refers to natural disasters as well as climate change. It also is the basis for looking at peace agreements that relate to durable solutions, especially in the context of conflict-induced displacement. It states quite clearly that its provision shall be included in the framework of peace agreements because of its importance in addressing IDP issues. It does reach to development-induced displacement, and there requiring clearly the need to identify feasible alternative forms of location, preventing induced displacement in the first place, and really that it is an alternative, and the obligation to carry out environmental risk assessment in any case where development projects are going to be embarked upon in the context. This was also problematic because some states didn't actually want any development-induced displacement to enter the convention at all and objected on that ground. Others were persuaded by the argument that, well, this is the rubric. If you're going to engage with development actors that fund development projects that might lead to the displacement of populations, then Africa will say, well, this is our framework for dealing with this and we'll be bound by this framework. And that argument seemed to have prevailed in relation to others. There's also a very strong theme about compensation and reparation, that in addition to durable solutions, it has to be recognized that IDPs are persons whose rights have been violated. And compensation, of course, addresses narrowly the damage that has been done, whereas reparation attempts to repair the damage and to restitute the situation that would have existed before. And both of those were delicately negotiated and finally found their way. And reparation will apply clearly in situations where, in the context of natural disasters, for example, a state neglects to extend protection to the victims of natural disasters as displaced persons. That was negotiated and put in the convention after the events in Myanmar, where in the aftermath of an earthquake, the government actually refused to grant access to humanitarian organizations to one part of the country, which was seen as politically disobedient. And there it was thought that those kinds of situations must be addressed fully within the convention. So it was also informed by developments not just happening in Africa, but developments that had happened elsewhere. Then a note on implementation. It calls clearly for the national legal policy frameworks to be formulated in order to domesticate the convention at national level. The African Union has prepared model law on this issue. But there's also an issue of compliance with the obligations in the light of not just the objectives, frameworks, categories involved. It's very strong in identifying protection for women, children, and the elderly, and persons with disabilities. That, again, is an important aspect of the convention. Finally, a note on the issue of compliance and monitoring, which exercised the minds of the drafters and the states parties that the convention should not be open-ended in terms of simply laying obligations and assuming that states will automatically comply with those obligations. So the first thing was to make this as a self-participatory process, to have a conference of states parties to monitor and review the implementation of the convention in the light of its objectives every so often. But the understanding was that this meeting would take place every 5 years. 5 years was not spelt in the convention because it was felt that would introduce a rigidity. Nonetheless, the phase for review was every 5 years as agreed. It also integrates the monitoring function of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights so that when the commission examines state reports, it also uses the framework as a basis for examining those reports in relation to IDPs. It incorporates the African peer review mechanism under the NEPAD framework, in relation to which every African state is peer reviewed every 2 or 3 years, much the same way as the Human Rights Council invokes the universal periodical review mechanism. And this was incorporated so that both of those aspects would also be used to review implementation. IDPs have the right to file complaints to the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, as well as the African Court on Human Rights, which still is an aspect about compliance in relation to the convention. Finally, well, what are the challenges? Understanding the convention itself is a challenge. It looks very lean, very thin, but it carries a great deal of underlying detail, both in terms of law, policy, framework, and its relationship to the guiding principles in the context of protection. And for this reason, the Brookings LSC project is preparing a commentary or annotations to the convention to make them, you know, public and to make the convention more understood in that context. It's also important to benchmark implementation, i.e. what are the benchmarks of implementing the convention? And this is also part of this process and part of the discussions that are going on to establish indicators of the requirements for implementation. And I also see the final challenge as operationalization of the convention following implementation. You can have a narrow legal aspect of implementation, which actually hits all the right buttons. You have domestication, which reflects the convention, the benchmarks, but this is an instrument that is intended and was designed to be operational and to be operationalized in the field where it actually really matters. And there the issue of implementation in actual situations of IDPs is still a long-standing challenge and goal to be reached. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chiloka. For those who are also interested in the challenge that Chiloka flagged of understanding the convention itself, I'd also note that there are several shorter resources that are available on the website of the Brookings LSC Project on internal displacement, in addition to the commentary that Chiloka mentioned as being under preparation. I believe that some copies of those resources are also available on the table on your way out, so please do pick those up if you haven't already. And without further ado, I'll turn it over to Niels.
Thank you, Megan. I'm always nervous when somebody does something like this to me. Elizabeth, can you hear me down there? Too much or too little? Okay, good. You know, as Megan mentioned when she introduced us here, I work in the World Bank and I lead a program called the Global Program on Forced Displacement in the Bank. And I think I will... Now, when both Megan and Chiloka has explained you everything about the Kampala Convention, I don't want to do that. I maybe want to talk a little bit about that program we do in the bank and how that then relates to the Kampala Convention, because some of you may think, well, how on earth does that happen? You know, conventions are done by convention people, and they do things, and they are difficult to understand, as Chiloka say, and what does that have to do with development? So I'll spend a little time here in the graveyard session after lunch to keep us, hopefully, from falling asleep by saying a few words about the rationale for why we have this program in the bank. I think it's important for us to remind ourselves about the scope of forced displacement due to conflict, war, persecution, and all that. I'm not talking about forced displacement by development projects. That's something entirely different. I'm not going to address that. we have the number of 43 million is often referred, where most of them are IDPs and the rest are refugees. I normally add another 20 million because of those displaced refugees or IDPs that have supposedly found solutions over the last 10, 15, 20 years and are off UNHCR and others' books have not found solutions. Or some of them have, but most of them haven't, actually. It's not more than half a year or a year ago that UNHCR assessed that the vast majority of the refugees that have returned to Afghanistan in the last 10 years, which is several million, have not found solutions. Well, they're off everybody's books. So there's an issue here. So that also means that if we talk about forced displacement globally, we are close to 1% of the world's population, if you add another 20 million on top of the 43 that we normally refer to. So I'll talk. So, and also it's important to remember that most displacement today, refugee or IDP related, is protracted. And if you look at it, when displacement is protracted, the needs and the concerns and the issues are more developmental than humanitarian, if you take them one by one. Nevertheless, it still seems to stay in the humanitarian box by those that deal with the humanitarian work and also those that think about it from policy concerns and so on. So the impact of displacement also has development impacts. You know, there can be a negative impact on human and social capital, economic growth, poverty reduction, negative impacts on the achievement of MDGs and whatever comes after that, and environmental degradation and all that. These are all developmental negative impacts. Sometimes these can be maybe made less negative or even in some cases be made positive if displaced people are allowed to move and be self-reliant and supported to live with more proactively with host communities when they are displaced. That's sort of the impact side. The development challenge per se starts already during displacement, where if development actors get it right and policymakers get it right, then you can work on strengthening the capacity of hosting communities so that they are better able to look after displaced. You can support a higher level of self-reliance of displaced. You can maybe seek more support programs that provide interaction between displaced and locals. All this to avoid camps, which has a kilometer-long list of negative implications that I don't even want to start mentioning. I agree that often, sometimes there's no option. You have to have camps, but sometimes it becomes the default reaction for decades. Camps should, as far as possible, be a short-term option. And then when solutions come about, the traditional solutions, either return or local integration where you are displaced or in some third country, then the full-fledged pillars, as we define it, we have four pillars we talk about that where development needs to kick in, and that has to do with reestablishment of housing productive capacity. It has to do with restitution or reestablishment of livelihoods. It has to do with regaining access to services or equal access to services or access to equal services, depending on how you look at it. And lastly, it also has to do with accountable governance, often at the local level. How displaced people, when they are returned or find solution, are included, what voice do they have in decision-making and all that. So you may be wondering why I'm sitting here and working in the World Bank and saying all these things, whether you agree with them or not. But I think the bank has actually done more about this than many other development actors have. It hasn't by far done enough, in my opinion. But then three years ago, when I got the opportunity to start this program, we took stock of what the bank had done up until then, which was not that insignificant, actually. It just had been done on an ad hoc basis and not in any systematic way. So we established this program that I now lead, which is now an eight-year program, three and a half years down the line, that would seek to improve the way the bank would deal with forced displacement and also serve to give good ideas to other development actors, bilateral development actors, USAID and others, as well as UN agencies and NGOs. So the program is not operational in itself, but it supports in three different ways operations in the bank. It can either support country teams or bank teams that are designing operations, or we can perform analytical work that supports operations. And right from the beginning, we have had a very strong partnership approach dealing with bilaterals, UN agencies, and NGOs as we have moved along. In terms of examples of analytical work, global analytical work, we have recently concluded or finalized a methodology for how to measure impact of displacement, which has sort of never really been done in terms of both social, economic, and fiscal. We are also about to finalize an assessment tool on how to better create, recreate livelihoods for displaced people, either temporarily in displacement or completely when you find a solution. In terms of operations, we have supported recently a large operation on housing and livelihoods in Azerbaijan, for instance, where some of you may know there are a large number of IDPs. We have been working closely with the bank team in South Sudan to design a local government service delivery program that, amongst other things, is supposed to take care of an inclusive approach to integration of returnees and so on. We have worked with and that was involving both the UN and a number of bilaterals as well in both consultations and design phase. And in Eastern Sudan, we've been working with the government, UNHCR and UNDP, and a couple of bilaterals for a couple of years to design a area-based development program that's supposed to improve socioeconomic livelihoods of nationals, IDPs, and refugees in order to try and see a humanitarian exit, where UNHCR for 40 years or more now, I think, has provided humanitarian-type assistance with a little bit of self-reliance, but obviously not getting out of that box doing so. this is in its early stages. It is not easy, but it's a very interesting example of what we do. We also, for a number of years, worked with the Colombian government on the protection of patrimonial assets, which laid the groundwork for the signing of the victims' law, which the government now is in the process of implementing, and we are working with the government to help them implement that. I think, in addition to the Kampala Convention, I think the victims' law in Colombia is equally important when it comes to policies and examples of how to deal well with displacement issues. We have in the program, these were just a few examples. We have a small team, so there's a limit to what we can do, but we work maybe with 20 or 25 different country situations where we work with bilaterals and the UN agencies that are interested in this part and bank country teams. And I forgot to mention the most important thing, because that's why I came here or was invited to come here, and that is supposed to be the link between what I do here in that program and the Kampala Convention. And in terms of global analytical work, we actually did a piece on the development perspectives of the Kampala Convention. And the idea to this came, I'm not sure, but I think it was under Nansen's boat in Oslo, his polar ship, that where Walter Kellin and Chaloka and myself were discussing life and Kampala Convention, and we saw that as an opportunity here to with the Kampala Convention to also bring in the development aspects that are so obvious, and try to avoid that a convention of this nature would not be treated as a legal issue dealt with by legal people and humanitarian people, because intuitively people would think that something about IDPs, that's where it belongs, and that's fine, and then everybody else would go about their business as usual. So we talked about this, and then we started through the program that I have with some funding we got from the Nordic Trust Fund on Human Rights that exists in the bank to do this book, which you can access on the net. Walter Kellin was the main drafter of that. The opportunity for development actors, the Kampala Convention and opportunities for development actors, it's called. And And you can see it on the forced displacement website in the bank. I can see you can also maybe get it on IDMC's website, I think. And so, and we also, we did two things. We developed that piece of analytical work, because development people, they need to have a piece of analytical work before they do anything. So we knew that was important. But we also contacted AU and IDMC, who were sort of working on promulgating and making sure that all the numbers that Megan mentioned actually came about. And 12 months ago, it wasn't at all sure that we would reach as far as as we are today. So when the AU was drafting the model law that Chaloka was referring to, and going back to the under Nansen ship discussion that Walter and Chaloka and me had, we then contacted the AU and suggested that we could help them by inviting some development people from various countries in Africa to be part of the expert meeting that would meet in Mombasa, as the case was, I think it was in June last year, to finalize this model law that the AU would throw after government that has ratified the convention for them to use when they put things into motion in their respective countries. And that actually worked quite well in the sense that it did break the ice between the type of people that normally does that type of things, legal instruments and convention work, and development people. So that was a little bit of an example of why the hell does this guy for the World Bank sit here when we talk about a convention? So that connect was made there. We also, we followed up with supporting a workshop organized by IDMC in Entebbe, close to Kampala this time. Since it was in Entebbe, it was for the Ugandan government and civil society in Uganda and other people in Uganda, in the Uganda scenario, to discuss how do we then, as a nation, Uganda, apply and operationalize, as Chaloka was mentioned, as one of the challenges, the convention in Kampala, in Uganda. And Uganda has a lot of experience with both refugees and IDPs, and they were building on that. There was a two-day workshop that actually was seen as a first step in the Uganda process, to led by the Ugandan government itself, to make sure that the action plan they put into place make sure that all aspects, all bases are covered in the way they would implement it, including the developmental aspects, which we, through the model law, which their action plan is based on, had made sure is included there. So we managed to get the development language and thinking and philosophy into this, and also an understanding amongst the Ugandans that dealt with this, that it's not only for us to sign up to this, and then it's just a matter of more blue plastic sheet, and then hope for the best. It's also about including displacement issues and the issues that are outlined in the convention in national development plans, without which, of course, you cannot have any development operations. So the first steps were taken to that. I'm not saying this is easy, because development plans have a tendency to take a long time to be developed. But the first steps were taken, and the right things were said by the right people in the same room, as opposed to that not have had happened. And that's an important thing to note, I think. So, I mean, I should stop rambling now also, I can feel. But if there's anything I would conclude with, I think it is about responsibility, as was also mentioned earlier, and recognition. Government must recognize their responsibility and recognize that displacement is not only a humanitarian issue and a rights issue, it's also a developmental issue, and it should go into national development plans. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Niels. And without further ado, I'll pass the floor over to Andrea.
Thank you very much, Megan. I thank you for inviting me here to share a few ideas with all of you, and I'll try to make my remarks short Well, first of all, Refugee International has been working on internal displacement crisis in Africa for many years, and over the years we have expanded our attention in terms of advocacy from working on the international framework and structure whenever a government is either incapable or unwilling to intervene and protect its own people to do so. So we have been working on that particular axis, but in the last 2-3 years, and being the Kampala Convention a great opportunity to move further, deeper into the process, we have tried to understand how we can help as an advocacy Western-based organization to push for partnership, making an effective partnership, and also having an operationalization of the convention. I think these are the two concepts that I really take from your Chaloka presentation, and I like to keep two words always in mind throughout my points. I've left a few reports from our organization on the counter outside, and that I think exemplified our focus on Mali, DRC, Somalia, displacement situation, so please, you're welcome to pick them up. The Kampala Convention does recognize strongly throughout its own structure a critical role the civil society organizations and communities that are actually welcoming displaced in assisting and protecting the very same displaced people. I think that partnership is a cornerstone concept we need to think and keep in mind when we look at the implementation of the convention. But we also need to be a bit honest and realistic. Well, an effective partnership can only happen if the parties in the partnership have not equal capacity, but sufficient capacity to engage at a meaningful level. Because we have major institutions, the World Bank with significant resources, governments with significant resources, with the monopoly of security and the use of force whenever they like and they don't like. So I would like to bring here another component of this partnership that are the civil society. And I think it's extremely important to make sure that we as foreigners, we as institutions coming from abroad, would look at this particular group as an important actor that would enable the implementation of the convention. And I will focus on 2 points only at the national country levels. First point is, and I think that we should find ways to support the strengthening of civil society. And when I say civil society, is an all-encompassing number of groups. It's host communities, it's churches, is also organizations representing the displaced themselves. I mean, I really like to stress over and over the need of having the very same displaced people, and particularly in the most frequent context of protected displacement, being able and capable to advocate for themselves and negotiate with the same authorities that should provide them with assistance and protection. And then I would say that supporting these different organizations would actually lead from an accountability from below. So we are talking about how can we support governments to sign, then ratify, then move into domestic legislation, and finally operationalize this legislation from the top down. I would bring it to the other side. How can we support citizens in countries affected by forced displacement and enforced displacement require their own government to do this process, to engage on this process? And then I think, as I said, we need to work at different level with the civil society, and we can use different tools. I mean, I recall during the period of spreading and sharing the concept of the UN Guiding Principle on Internal Displacement, there were a lot of events done in Africa where organizations, international, local, were working together, trying to make awareness in the countries about what were the UN Guiding Principle. I think we should start thinking of a similar process with the Kampala Convention, having a kind of an holistic approach. And perhaps we can start, and again, I'm going now to throw some points that will probably spark some question afterward, start with a practical suggestion, where we could start with some specific countries. I mean, again, the convention is very wide, is all-encompassing, is comprehensive, is huge, is very demanding, would require a lot of resources to implement. Why can't we try to help and start with those countries that have both signed and ratified? Mali is one point in case. Although there is not a great degree of stability right now in Mali, and there are other priorities, but look, why don't we think about starting with 1, 2, 3 countries in Africa that have signed and ratified, or are about to ratify, to start working with with these strengthening and supporting local groups, organization, we could then provide resources, and that is a suggestion that could be useful for donor organization, governments, World Bank. We could provide resources for local human rights organization. We have different human rights organizations very active in Africa that perhaps do not look at internal displacement issues as a human rights issue immediately, or perhaps they do. Oftentimes they look at the human rights issues that are not perceived through the lenses of humanitarian needs. And I have oftentimes heard that humanitarian needs of IDPs in a given country is the business of the humanitarian organization. It's the UN, UNHCR, it's OCHA, the donors. It's not business of local people, national organization. Well, this is, I think, a mentality that should be challenged big time. And we can start with these human rights organizations, very active. They have networks. We can start with church groups that have a very efficient, effective networks countrywide in these countries. And in some cases, we can start with the human rights commissions that in some countries, and I guess because Shaloka can refer some of those countries, are very effective, and they push respect and protection of specific rights of population. And I think we should challenge them to pick up issues of internal displacement. And finally, I would say that we should dedicate resources and attention, especially in protected displacement situation, to supporting leadership of IDPs themselves, of communities, and host communities that are bearing the burden of protection and assistance well beyond anything we can think. We normally, and I say we as external institution, international humanitarian organization, UN agency, multilateral agency, we always think that we are doing essential important work. Well, yes, it is important, but the scope, the magnitude of the protection and assistance that the very same people welcoming IDPs is provided is beyond our own understanding. I mean, this I've seen over and over in different trips I did in Africa. And let me bring just one example that actually brings me back 20 years almost when I worked in Angola during one of the humanitarian crises there, where a combination of a religious group called Justice and Peace Commission that we then renamed Justice, Peace and Forced Migration Commission, the human rights unit within the United Nations Mission or Observation Mission in Angola, so UN, an organization providing humanitarian assistance to IDPs, and leadership of internal displaced groups. We all worked together, and we organized a couple of days meetings. So the first day was, let's work all together, understand what really the IDPs need and what the local community needs in helping the IDPs. And the following day, the international, as good officers or diplomatic effort, invited central government and local government officials and facilitated the dialogue between those in need of assistance protection, those that should provide some of the assistance protection. And I think that this could be an example, it could be kind of a mechanism, an example that could be used with the Kampala Convention. And perhaps like supporting this kind of gathering, because it is an effort that has to happen from the bottom up and from the top down, not just one sense. And I think finally, well, just want to say that, again, I repeat on Mali, that could be an interesting exercise. First of all, because I was in Mali very recently, I was very surprised by some of the positive elements that I found in many of the households and in many of the communities that were hosting a majority displaced in the south of Mali. And I found a lot of dedication, a lot of commitment from local technical level government officials. One of our recommendations is also to have Uchaloka visiting Mali possibly as soon as possible. And I think it's one of the countries that have signed and ratified. It's a complex situation. I do understand that there are different dynamics happening, but I think it's a great opportunity. So as a final words, and I will be happy to throw some ideas about how the USG in particular can help in this process of, I think, making a partnership effective and supporting this sector of the partnership I mentioned about and helping the operationalization of the convention at the ground level, at the level of those that are facing the displacement, those that are helping them in the first place. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much, Andre, and to all three of our speakers. I'll now open the floor to questions that you might have. If you could raise your hand and we have a microphone that we brought by. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. I have a question, kind of a complex question, about the looking for strategies for resettling IDPs, and also kind of connected to that, strategies for getting countries that might not have already signed to sign. As you mentioned, Kenya hasn't signed or ratified, but they have a very active domestic debate on the question of IDPs. And I think one of the things that's preventing civil society in Kenya from pushing harder to get Kenya to sign is that, at least in Kenyan media, you don't see clear answers or a unified, coherent idea of what should be done about the IDPs. So you've seen a lot of confusion. The government, you know, offering IDPs money, but then that doesn't work very well. Or resettling IDPs, but then sometimes the IDPs don't want to go to the land that they're being offered. Or some voices in civil society saying, don't resettle the IDPs because we should have the government protecting their title deeds and protect them going back to the places that they've left. So you don't see a consensus, a public consensus, on what the government should do, and therefore it's hard to kind of rally behind an effort to get the government to do that. So perhaps that's something that the AU could do, is, or the civil society could do, is to develop these tools, kind of expectations of what the government needs to do. Do they need to give IDPs a choice of either going back and being protected or being resettled? And if they're going to be resettled, what should they be able to expect? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And if I could ask each speaker to identify themselves and the organization that they're coming from as well, that would be great.
My name is Devin Knudsen, and I just recently worked for the Kenyan government.
Thank you. Chulka, do you want to start off in answering that question?
Yes, well, thanks very much. Fortunately, I spent about 2 years in Kenya working on their constitution, and one of my missions was also to Kenya at the very beginning. So the situation that you're addressing is somewhat familiar. In terms of why Kenya hasn't ratified the AU Convention, it's because of the fact that their new constitution automatically applies as part of Kenyan law or treaties ratified by the government of Kenya. Now, that was intended to address the problem whereby treaties were being ratified but not being implemented. So all pre-existing treaties, by virtue of the constitution, became applicable law. With regard to the African Union Convention, they intend to sign it Easter, but they say they'll wait until, because of the nature of the constitutional provisions, they are going to pass a law which elaborates the process by which treaties are ratified so that they become part of Kenyan law. And I think they're actually sincere about that. But they've ratified the Great Lakes Protocol on the basis of which, as you know, last year, legislation on IDPs was actually adopted and signed by the president into law, making Kenya one of the very few countries in Africa with a comprehensive peace of legislation. And my mandate was involved in the draft of that piece of legislation. Nina is somewhere in this room. So to get to that, we had to work with UNHCR, we had to work with the ministries, we had to work with the Refugee Consortium of Kenya as the umbrella for civil society groups. We also had to work with the National Human Rights Commission and the Protection Working Group, which is fairly well integrated between government, civil society. So there we're fully engaged all the time to make sure that this legislation comes about and that the policy also comes about. So the legislation itself, insofar as it applies the Great Lakes Protocol, which is to some extent similar to the African Union Convention from the point of view of the guiding principles, would achieve the same papers. But I think that they are minded to ratify the convention as soon as they've passed their law, which governs the way in which our treaties under the new constitution will be ratified. In terms of IDPs and the media and strategies for resettling IDPs, I think the coverage by the media of IDPs in Kenya is actually a good thing, because you, whichever voice comes up, in some places you find that IDPs are ignored altogether. But the media coverage depends very much on which aspect of the political pendulum is swinging. As you're aware, the issue of IDPs in Kenya is highly political. It has followed a cycle of each election from the early 1990s to 1996 and 2007. And I think it's quite a good thing that at least this election has not produced any more IDPs, even if there are reports of night displacements in some places around Nakuru, you know, for example, Nyarandua, where we had gone to. But the dynamics of resettlement there are simply about the political forces. First of all, at the level of the government, there was not much consultation with IDPs in terms of what solution is appropriate for IDPs. Did they want to remain where they were, or did they want to go back? We met many IDPs who said, look, if I had some kind of compensation package, I'm an entrepreneur, I'll go and set myself anywhere. I don't need a piece of land, you know, to go back to some place. And then the policy of buying land without consulting both the IDPs and the local communities were in trouble because the receiving communities sometimes objected and said, look, we don't want IDPs here. No public awareness had taken place. But after some of these issues we addressed, and awareness, I think, was an important thing on the part of the Kenyan government, they actually began to resettle IDPs on the basis of consulting them and also populations and communities to where they were going. Now, what has happened after the election is that, you know, the local political leadership has changed in some of those places. And the reason why the political leaders are so concerned is that bringing in IDPs on a resettlement program changes the dynamics of the population in terms of who vote for whom at what point in time. So although some of the departed political leaders like MPs had accepted resettlement as a policy, the new ones are questioning that. And hence there is anxiety again on the part of IDPs, and some of those who were said to be resettled, the resettlement program, you know, has stopped. And then you also have instances where the whole process was kind of fumbled in relation to the Mau Forest evictees who were said to be resettled but were not resettled, and have now taken the advantage in the change of government, or the lacuna at least, to go back to the Mau Forest. And that's a challenge. Is government going to evict them from the Mau Forest again? But we hope that the new legislation and the policy framework that has gone with it will provide a cohesive framework which will engage all organs of the Kenyan government at least to act in one direction, and also to apply the well-known principles in the context of durable solutions. And hopefully by the time they implement the African Union Convention, I don't think that there'll be much actually that they'll have to do in terms of the legislation that they already have.
Thank you very much, Chiloka. Other questions from the audience? Please.
Thank you. I'm Michael Moore. I'm with Landmines in Africa. Within the lens of mine action, persons who are displaced are at a higher risk of landmine and UXO injury as they pass through minefields or return to homes that are now within minefields. Article 11 of the Convention, speaking about implementation, provides for safety upon return. I'd like to know more about how that article may be implemented, and not just within the context of mine action. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Actually, I didn't hear the question.
Towards the back, on the right-hand side? The woman, yes, thank you. Oh, there's a microphone right behind you.
Hi, I'm Jill Shankerman. I'm a consultant on extractive industries and a senior scholar at the Wilson Center. So I was interested to hear that this applies to development-induced displacement and that encompasses all actors. So I guess my question is, what could you make any comment on the implications for private sector companies, for example, you know, that tend to be in, that have projects that can involve, well, what we call involuntary resettlement? So, you know, mines, hydro projects, dams, large plantations. So what, if any, are the implications for companies?
Thank you very much. And as moderator, I'd like to introduce an additional question into the mix. And this is around the implications of the Kampala Convention for other regions that are interested in addressing internal displacement, whether through regional organizations or in other means. In what sense might the Kampala Convention provide a useful example for other regions of the world? So we'll start with Niels, then we'll head down the panel.
Yes. I'm not sure I have much to add to this because, as I said earlier, my area or niche of work in the bank has to do with displacement due to conflict and persecution and so on, and not development-induced displacement. The bank has, of course, a whole set of different types of safeguards that applies to that, and if programs are done through the bank, these things apply. And I think I'll leave it at that because I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I know so much about it. So sometimes it's better to shut up. So I'll do that.
Fair enough.
I actually didn't hear the first question, whether it related to Article 11 of the Convention. Yeah. It wasn't clear.
Sorry. The first question pertained, if I understood correctly, to issues around landmines and safe return to communities that have been affected by landmines.
Okay, that's fine then. Thank you. Thank you very much for the questions. In the context of safe return and landmines, Article 11 makes the framework for durable solutions in the context of safe return, quite obviously. And there, the reference is to sustainable return, that return must be sustainable. So the requirement is that if there are actually landmines, then obviously return may not be sustainable until the landmines have been cleared. And there, the idea of partnership behind the convention is that those organizations that have expertise in landmine clearing, which you find in places like Sudan, previously Angola and Mozambique, I think they're still effectively involved in those areas, would then come to assist particular countries where return is actually sort of prohibited or constrained by landmines. That's a huge issue. And of course, you also have the framework of the Landmines Convention, which might apply in that context. But the practice is fairly well established. But what Article 11 would require is the measure of sustainable return, and whether that return is sustainable. If it isn't, then obviously that solution would not apply. And you'd have to look at a balance between either local integration or resettlement, or indeed being in places where IDPs are displaced for the time being. There's then the question about development-induced displacement and private actors. We had tried, just as the Great Lakes Protocol does in the framework of this convention, to have a definition of IDPs that also includes displacement by projects. But it was felt that in keeping with the faith of the guiding principles, we should retain one definition, but however, make sure that there's actually scope for including the activities of private companies. So when you look to Article 1, which defines the terms of the convention, there's a definition of non-state actors. Now, non-state actors are distinct from armed groups that are dissident forces in relation to the state. That distinction is quite clear. So non-state actors will include private companies. It's clear from the scope of Article 1, if I may, it just give you an indication of that. And non-state actors means private actors who are not public officials of the state, including other armed groups not referred to in Article 1D above, and whose acts cannot be officially attributed to the state. That then is followed by Article 10, displacement-induced projects. First of all, they need to prevent this, and then feasible alternatives with full information. And then, of course, carry out a socioeconomic and environmental impact assessment. So the requirement here is that non-state actors who have to live by those obligations in the first place, so that displacement is a measure of last resort on account of development-induced displacement. There's the spirit of the guiding principles, which requires that any displacement based on development project must be in the public interest and must also be sufficiently overwhelming and compelling on that basis. So there is clear scope for dealing with that and making sure that the activities of these companies are brought to account. That was a measure of great debate within the framework of the African Union Convention. And the Great Lakes Protocol is actually much more clearer because it was easier to get consensus at sub-regional level than at the bigger regional level. As I say, you clearly had states such as Egypt, Ethiopia, Gabon in the first instance as well, that were against end provisions, and Botswana on development-induced displacement. Then you had Tanzania, Uganda, to some extent the DRC, who were saying, no, we need clear provisions on aspects of projects or displacement induced by projects. So having had that compromise, the next thing was, okay, how do we find language that would speak to both ends? And the language actually started, first of all, from the guiding principles to make displacement as a measure of last resort in that regard, and then to have the obligation that if it's going to be undertaken, then clearly all feasible alternatives have to be explored with full information and consultation of persons likely to be affected by those projects, so that there's a process that goes within it. And then the states, having licensed this to happen, will have an obligation to carry out a socioeconomic and environmental impact assessment of the proposed development project prior to undertaking such a project. So those are onerous obligations on the part of states and the way in which the convention attempts to deal with it. And then Megan threw a question about, well, is it a model for other regions? It may very well be. If you remove the terms African Union Convention and anything that's African in this convention, it would apply to any situation of displacement wherever in the world. And if the world actually wanted to have a convention on IDPs, which I wouldn't push for because of the dynamics, but for argument's sake, you'd have to do the reverse of what was done to the 1951 convention relating to the status of refugees, which originally was a European-based framework and was amended in 1967 to make it universal in terms of its application. So you'd have to do the reverse of this and remove the title African Union Convention and everything that's African Union in it and leave the rest of the terms, and there you'd have a convention. But that's a tall order, you know, because there are different political dynamics. And I think that quite critically, each region would have to generate the political will. This happened because African states themselves actually had the political will, and it came from them. No one said, you know, you should do this. There was no pressure from the outside. It was a homegrown initiative which made it possible to pursue. But if you wanted to impose a similar sort of development elsewhere, then you'd get different results. So my approach would be, in the context of other regional bodies, use their human rights frameworks, which exist, the Inter-American system and the Convention and Declaration, the European Convention, and now the ASEAN Declaration has come about, to try and see where IDPs fit within those frameworks. Both the Inter-American and European systems already have fairly well-established jurisprudence and case law on the protection of IDPs in a variety of contexts. And so within those frameworks, I think it's important to push for protection, whereas the attempt to have a sort of either an external convention driven by external forces would actually produce awkward results, which might diminish what we already have. Mm-hmm. And there's always the risk of making sure that we keep the integrity. But if the European Union tomorrow or the OAS said, yeah, we want a convention on IDPs, then of course that's their thing. And I think you'd have a range of international actors and other experts helping with that process. But it has to be theirs. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll start from this last question, and in terms of other regions, and having worked a lot on the Western Hemisphere, I've seen a very steep decline when it comes to Latin America, for instance, Central America. Even the Refugee Convention, when it's been regionalized, is regionalized with declaration, the Cartagena Declaration. So there is a high-level resistance of sovereign states in Latin America to even consider any interference that given related to refugees. So I would say, on the other side, we have extremely developed and very sophisticated national framework. So we have achieved what we are trying to get with the incorporation of a regional convention into national domestic legislation. But yet there are a lot of gaps even in that particular case. I'm just thinking about Colombia, where there's a wealth of national legislation. But something that I've seen common, and this is why I was pushing a lot on the role of the civil society, the great change in Colombia when it came to implementation of the law that was passed in 1997 happened when 30,000 petitioned by individuals, displaced people, were sent to the Constitutional Court of Colombia, demanding a response from the government of Colombia about the protection and the assistance of their own needs. That was the push that forced the Constitutional Court to demand the government of Colombia to live up with his own responsibility. And that was almost exclusively an activity performed by individuals from displaced communities, civil society, legal advisor groups, filing petitions through the constitutional framework that was available in that country. In terms of the safe returns in mine action programs, I think, again, I don't have anything to add to the interpretation of the article. I would say that in the pragmatic experience I had, for instance, in Angola, that oftentimes the return is considered as the priority and the most likely, the most durable or desirable solution. First of all, we should talk to the people. First of all, we need to really do an assessment of the environment, because in a country like Angola, many Angolans didn't care about going back to the same areas unless they were religious or other consideration. But there is so much land, there was no need to demine. This was kind of an option to relocate or to develop economic activities in other areas within the same region, and having the state being able to provide alternatives. And this has actually worked in that case. And finally, in terms of the implication of private sector, I will look at the next step beyond the provision that Chaloka referred to. There are all provisions that should be respected before an intervention before the awarding of a concession, before starting digging out mines, before displacing people. Well, I think there is a real need to pay attention to what's happening after that. Because in many cases, while the legal process takes its own course, that takes time, things are happening. And most recent discussion of most recent case in Mozambique about coal mines, new discovery of coals in other areas in Mozambique. Well, what's happening? It is already happening. The companies are already investing, have already signed agreements with the government. And then what's happening to the people? So I think the whole aspect of following through in terms of commitment of the companies and the state, compensation, viability of alternative solution in terms of residence and livelihood, and possibly even consider and consultation throughout the whole process, not just at the beginning, keeping a continuous consultation with community affected, because people might end up to a better place where they were before. So we should be sometimes even pragmatic and look at different options. And finally, there is a provision that I was looking at when it comes to let me just put the papers here, let's second a bit of patience. That I was looking earlier, there is a provision in the ordinary session of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. Special Rapporteur on Refugees, Asylum Seekers, Internal Displacement and Migrants in Africa, that every 2 years reports back to at the African Commission and reports back on several cases. And there is a section in these 2 days where civil society is allowed to present cases and bring them to the to the attention to the Commission and the African Union. So this is another tool can be used once you have supported local organization, human organization, to put together these statements, and in case of investment of private sector, in case of other situation like forced evictions in urban areas. This is another big problem that's happening in African cities, where urban areas are particularly valuable for big development programs in terms of housing programs. And this is, so I think there are tools that can be used and just help civil society groups to become acquainted and comfortable with those tools, skilled, and then use them.
Niels, you would like to add?
Yeah, now I can't keep my mouth shut anymore. I wanted to say something again. The intervention about the private sector made me think that there's something the private sector can actually do, in my opinion, and that is, as well as politicians and policymakers and development actors has to think about forced displacement, so should private sector people do. They can do a lot in terms of thinking about how their respective businesses could, in certain areas that have high level of either protracted displacement or return or whatever, think of how to expand their business or whatever, have a soft window in their business model or whatever it is, to support joint ventures between host communities and displaced. Because this is where there's always livelihoods, in the bigger scheme of things, is maybe the most important thing for displaced people. And often there's a disconnect between small-scale microfinance and how that hook or community development programs and how that hooks up to the local economy. And that link is very rarely established, and it requires at least two to tango, and therefore an more open mindset in the private sector for specific focus on this, I think, would go a long way.
Thank you. Roberta.
Roberta Cohen, Brookings. I have two questions, if I might. Chilokov, you sort of touched on some of this, but I want to make sure I understand it. There's the Great Lakes Protocol, and that requires states in that area to adopt laws and policies on internal displacement. And then you have the African Union Convention. So how is this playing out? You mentioned Kenya, I was listening, and is this reinforcing or duplicating, or how are these two instruments? There's a model law, I think, also for the Great Lakes, I seem to remember, and so you have an AU one. How does this promote ratification? Does this take away from? And who deals with that? That's one question. And the second question is really, from listening to everybody, which has really been very interesting and informative, is there an overall strategy for trying to promote the ratification and implementation of the Kampala Convention? There are pieces, just listening, I mean, there are pieces on Chiloka's dealing with governments and laws and policies, and I know the UNHCR, funded by the United States government sitting next to me, is looking at promoting laws and policies all around the world, but also in Africa, on internal displacement. And so you're dealing with governments in these cases. And then you have Andrea speaking very eloquently about civil society and bringing them in, national commissions, local governments, and you have the development actors as well. Is the AU, is the rapporteur at the AU on refugees and IDPs, or is there an office there that has to do with this convention? Or are NGOs, I mean, is there an overall strategy developing, putting together all these pieces to try to get implementation and ratification first and implementation?
Thank you very much. Time is running a bit short, so I think...
That's for Chiloka.
Yes, we'll just leave that as the last question. We'll give Chiloka the chance to respond, and if anyone else would like to weigh in.
Great questions, Roberta. Thank you very much. Your questions remind me of the early days when I came to Brookings, to engage with the project and displacement issues. But first, the relationship between the Great Lakes Protocol and the African Union Convention. Let's just say that the Great Lakes Protocol is what actually led to the African Union Convention being promoted, because the Great Lakes states started a while back, about 2003, to promote a protocol in the context of a post-conflict framework, and the human security dimensions of it meant that they had to look at refugees, IDPs, return, sexual violence, their protocols in all those areas. But one of those that they actually required was a protocol on IDPs, and they said specifically they wanted a protocol which would implement the guiding principles. They did not want to go beyond that. So when that protocol was designed, it was to give a framework of how to make the guiding principles legal and binding in the context of the International Conference on the Great Lakes. And that protocol was then ratified by all the 12 member states of the conference. When that happened, ECOWAS began speaking about its own protocol in West Africa. So the African Union then moved very quickly, detecting that perhaps, you know, the time had come to actually have an instrument, and passed their decision and started this particular process, which would be a continent-wide process. But unlike the Great Lakes Protocol, African Union practice does not permit annexing documents like the guiding principles. So the Great Lakes Protocol established a structure for the application of the guiding principles, and then the principles were annexed to the protocol so that they became part of the protocol. So here the approach was different, and it was that we have to infuse the guiding principles directly in the fabric of the instrument, make the instrument more wider than the Great Lakes Protocol. But the Great Lakes Protocol is always a fallback. And indeed, the suggestion was that if the whole framework of the convention collapsed, then we'd simply have something like the Great Lakes Protocol, very lean, which would annex the guiding principles and append. So the two are related. And indeed, we made sure that in the drafting, they spoke to each other. There is issues that are more explicit in the Great Lakes Protocol, like development-induced displacement, which are not so explicit in the African Union Convention, but nonetheless you find a framework for their application. The fact that the Great Lakes Protocol was ratified by all those states meant that it was easier for the member states of the International Conference to ratify the African Union Convention, and indeed that's part of the advocacy that we took. So it was not surprising that countries like Uganda and Zambia that are part of the conference took the lead in ratifying the African Union Convention. So it was a precursor to that, and they completely speak to each other in terms of the substance and aspects of implementation. The overall strategy to promote ratification, there was a fairly comprehensive and robust strategy organized by the partners to the African Union under the banner of the Friends of the Kampala Convention. So the first thing to do there was to make sure that we're all coordinated and sharing information in terms of what we did, the mandate, UNHCR, OCHA, or ICRC. Because what emerged is that each one of these and other partners had their own programs and policies on advocacy in terms of ratification. And therefore, states were responding to different initiatives. And the idea was to have one common initiative coordinated so that we all knew what we're doing where, and also in conjunction with the African Union. So the African Union had an action plan, and they led the convening of the regional conferences in Southern Africa, Eastern Central Africa, as well as in West Africa. And the partners then fed into that framework. And that whole framework was intended to raise awareness in terms of the need to ratify the convention. And I think that worked fairly well, and is one of the reasons why the convention was ratified in such a short time to enable it to enter in force according to the requirements in terms of the numbers of states that had to ratify it. But having said that, I think once it entered in force, I think the advocacy that was going towards ratification has kind of dropped back. Mm-hmm. which is a danger, that advocacy has to continue. We need a different type of advocacy in moving towards implementation because of the fact that here, the idea of partnerships is still quite critical, but we have to look at which aspects of the convention should be implemented in which way. Although it's an integrated framework, but it clearly incorporates different ideas in relation to different situations, all of which require different responses in terms of not just implementation. By that, I mean operationalization. The easiest by far, of course, is model law, domesticate. That's the easier part. But the more difficult part is actually how to make it operational and to think more clearly in terms of field presence and also responding more directly to the protection and assistance needs of IDPs on the ground so that it's not an instrument that is pitched up there. It should be clearly horizontal. And I think that that's a huge challenge. And there we need to work with the African Union. The Brookings LSE project has elaborated at least a roadmap in this direction in terms of how to implement the convention. The African Union is clearly involved in this. I went to Addis Ababa on the day it entered in force and shared some ideas with the African Union on how to collaborate. The African Union Special Rapporteur on Refugees, IDPs, was also present. Mm-hmm. And we're working together, and which is why the African Union Commission on Human and People's Rights was integrated in here mm-hmm. For the reasons that Larry mentioned, so that if there are monitoring activities, complaints, then anyone, including civil society, can use and activate the convention in the framework of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. There's also a further degree of cooperation because the special procedures of the Human Rights Council decided to work very closely with regional organizations. So at last year's special procedures meeting, our commissioners from the African Union were invited to attend the annual special rapporteurs meeting. And we shared some ideas on how to move forward. And I think that thankfully at this point in time, the special rapporteur of the African Commission on IDPs is also a member of the working group on the protection of the rights of persons of African descent. So we meet in Geneva at the annual meetings and share ideas on how to go forward in terms of making sure that you know they also have ownership of the convention and the more useful entry point when it comes to dealing with some of the politics around the convention.
Thank you. Niels, Andrea, any closing thoughts?
Oh, it's been a long day. I think from the bank side, or the program I lead, we would be keen to support if there are more workshops coming up, organized either by the AU or IDMC or any combination, like the one we had in Entebbe, to see whether we can support with development interventions at such workshops. That certainly would be something we would be willing to consider as part of the rollout plan that Celoka now explained.
Well, I imagine it won't be too long before people come and take you up on that offer. I think it's an important one.
Then I have to qualify it then, because, of course, then it depends on resources and time and all
that. Of course. Yes. Thank you
very
much.
But the will is there.
Thank you. And Andrea?
Just a final thought is about looking at the mandate, looking at Celoka and LLC and Brookings project as taking the leadership on and making institutions aware of the roadmap or the degree of the strategy that has been implemented so far. Because I speak on behalf of RI, but I could speak with that, you know, on behalf of other humanitarian advocacy organizations, I mean, the more knowledge we have of these, you know, the progress that has been achieved in implementing these roadmaps, the better it is for us in our interaction at the country level when we visit places that are hosting significant numbers of IDPs. We can share this information, we can provide advice or opportunities for local organization and other peer humanitarian organizations to be interested in plugging into this process. So mm-hmm. we look at Brookings, LSC, the mandate holder, the office of the mandate in Geneva and London to take the leadership, to show the leadership, and we'll be more than happy to collaborate in our own capacity as part of the non-governmental, non-operational advocacy community.
Well, thank you very much, Andrea. I think that this event is a step towards that longer-term process of making sure that we all continue to be informed about steps towards the implementation and operationalization of the convention. I hope that this is the beginning of a much longer conversation. I think as Chiloka's comments made very clear, this is a convention that came into effect quite quickly, but the effective operationalization will be a much longer-term undertaking. So we look forward to working with you all in that endeavor. Thank you very much for making the time to join us today.